Could be an understatement. Oh, and now I hope that I have paid the cost. 2 minutes, they go on by now. Call on you, 'cause I'm so busy thinking about kissing you. And now I won't do that without entertaining another thought. Out on the ocean surf, I'll have to pull myself together. Now it's harder, I'm not on my turf. Just me and those big old waves rolling in. 'Cause I'm so busy thinking about kissing you. And now I wanna do that without entertaining another thought. It's so unfinished. Our love affair, a voice in me is telling me to run away. I hope your feelings isn't diminished. I hope you need someone in your life, someone like me. 'Cause I'm so busy thinking about kissing you. And now I wanna do that without entertaining another thought. So busy thinking about kissing you. And now I want that without entertaining another thought.
You are listening to Smile Politely Radio. SmilePolitely.com is the place to go for all things local arts, culture, food and drink, music, opinion, tech, and much more. I'm Rebecca, and I'm joined in the studio today by Will Patterson. Will is the host of Hip Hop Express, which follows this show, and he's also a professor of educational policy at the UI, where he teaches in the College of Engineering. How are you, Will?
I'm fine, Rebecca. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Yeah. Well, thanks for joining me today to talk about all of your many projects and involvements. I know that, like many people in Champaign, you're somebody that wears a lot of different hats in the community. So to get us started, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the projects that you're currently involved in.
Sure. Probably one of the more exciting things that I'm involved with right now is teaching in the College of Engineering and really exploring the idea of what we call urban STEM and getting young people from urban communities part of the STEM conversation and part of the ecosystem. U of I is a phenomenal place, as you know, as it relates to engineering and tech. People from all over the world come here to learn, share, to do a number of things scholarly, get the knowledge they need, and often go back to their own spaces and create amazing things that sometimes end up back in our world, right? And so, you know, with everything that's been going on in urban communities with, you know, young people, policing, deindustrialization, the leave behind of that, there has to become a point where people are not consuming, they're producing. And so I want to get young people producing, as part of that conversation, and they do. And I use my current class, Decoding Dr. Dre, just kind of as a metaphor to do this whole conversation around genius and then ghetto genius. And what does that look like? I just did a workshop last weekend that had kids from North Champaign talking about genius and ghetto genius. And it was very interesting because I asked the question, I said, what do you think about ghetto, right? What does that mean? And they're like, it's negative. It's, you know, it's dangerous. It's dark. It's all these different things. There's shootings, things like that. I said, well, what do you think about genius? And they're like, it's positive. It's valued. It's smart. It's all those different things. And I'm like, well, do you consider North Champaign the ghetto? And it's like, no. I said, well, have there been shootings in North Champaign? They're like, yeah. I said, well, that's probably, it's been ghettoized. I said, but do you know smart people that are in the ghetto? They're like, yeah. Mm-hmm. I said, then there is ghetto genius, which means there is value in your space. And so that's how I immediately began teaching young people is, first of all, have value in your culture and what you bring to the table. See the value in it. And then you come to the table, not as someone with your hand out, but with somebody that has an equitable, or at least a contributing resource to offer to the conversation that could take it in a different direction to the next level. And we've seen how Dr. Dre with the Beats Audio Company has done that many times over with Samsung, Chrysler, Monster Cable, Hewlett Packard, and now Apple. And so this is truly culture that has come out of urban spaces that's made that the reality. And we're going to see more and more of that happen. So
you mentioned the course that you're currently teaching is Decoding Dr. Dre. Yes. And obviously you do Hip Hop Express here at WEFT. And also another one of your projects is Hip Hop Express, the mobile sound machine and mobile studio.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about that project? I'm also curious to know how music binds together a lot of the different projects and pedagogical things that you contribute to the community.
Absolutely. You know, Hip Hop Express as a mobile, what I call mobile archiving and now a recording studio, has had kind of like two lives. The first phase was a pilot study, and we had an Airstream that the College of Engineering and the College of Fine and Applied Arts, particularly the Crannard Art Museum, had. And then I used it to demonstrate this whole idea of engaging community in indigenous spaces by bringing university resources to those spaces to spark up a dialogue, to look at all the other things, whether it's affordable housing, community revitalization, all of those different things. People find a common bond around music and culture in a variety of different ways. And so I say, if you can stimulate a conversation there, then it gets unpacked in all the other areas. And so this be the tool. And so I had a colleague of mine, John Jennings, create a motif on the side of the trailer that reflected the Black music experience. And so you would have everything from B.B. King on the side of the trailer to Michael Jackson, to LL Cool J, to Etta James, so on and so forth. And so you never know, since we have in communities intergenerations, they see themselves and their experiences on the trailer. And that's when the dialogue is shared values. And that's where it begins. And so the trailer, the first phase was the introduction and show that it was authentic. And so people look for the trailer. Now, the second trailer is actually a real mobile recording studio that I found a guy in Ohio actually had it. So the Buckeyes had it. And I say that the line I came and took it. And so I went over there and negotiated with them, and they gave me the trailer. And it's actually a mobile recording studio from a recording studio down in Clarksville, Tennessee. Had it, and then they sold it, and a guy was using it in Ohio at festivals and things like that for karaoke and recording. And so I'm like, wow, we could use that, and I could really demonstrate with this, with technology being part of, and really a lot of technology being centered around the device in our pocket, as Dan Coffin from Google talks about, that this computer that's in our pocket, it's not a phone, it's a computer with a ton of power. What does that look like in terms of, as we start looking at digital recording, more tools that interface where you have apps and things that can do a lot of the bigger, filtering and a variety of sound effects and things like to give you digital quality sound. That can happen with a plug-in these days on your phone.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get digital quality sound. So, but the big issue with that is power. How do you get enough power to make certain that your device is running? And so I started thinking about, you know, how can we start looking at having solar power recording devices, where if you're going to be mobile, then how can that be realized? And so the trailer, then I said, if I can demonstrate through creating this mobile recording studio that's actually solar powered, mm-hmm. now we can have a conversation about not only solar powered in terms of running studios, but then also solar powered relates to homes that could be in, you know, in impoverished communities. How do we get them part of, you know, off the grid and then really looking at this whole idea of sustainable energy and how it can be used in those communities? And so it serves again as a way to have a much larger conversation about sustainable energy in the conversation through popular culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You were describing sounds not only like inspiration for technology and engineering projects, but obviously also a kind of archive, mobile archive. Yeah. How did you become you in terms of combining all of these different kinds of interests? What's your background in, that led you to be able to kind of think across, obviously disciplines, but media and spaces?
Yeah. Well, my background, I always say I'm a street DJ by number one first. And so I've had a love for radio since I was a kid. I just loved the dynamic of radio. I've always loved it in terms of the vision that it creates, because it's theater of the mind. And so it's like you can be, oh man, just anything. And I would love going to different cities and feeling the pulse of the city through radio stations. And DJs would bring that to life in a variety of different ways. So I've always been in love with the art form itself. And then as a young teen, when hip hop came on the scene, it actually gave me my voice. It actually voiced me in a space where society had not seen me, and I hadn't bought into what society was offering as a young teen. But hip hop was speaking to me. Run DMC spoke loud and clear. So did LL Cool J and Public Enemy. These were the groups that were hot at the time, a young teen. And that's when I started, along with several friends of mine, started having production crews and DJing teams. But we had time and didn't know it were small businesses. I mean, we'd throw parties and things like that. We'd make money, but we were doing it for fun. And so we now see that fast forward that 20, 30 years, and you have what you see with Beats Out, know, Dr. Dre being from a very similar background as my own, around the same age. What was going on in the hood on the West Coast was the same thing happening here in the Midwest, down south, on the East Coast. It was all the same in terms of the impact of deindustrialization and how people find their own voice again, mm-hmm. in spite of that particular circumstance. And so I thought about that and knew that I wanted to expand I went out of wanting to manage rap groups. I did that. Was on the hip hop scene in Chicago, did a lot of that. But then I found out that I said I could make more of an impact through education, mm-hmm. With hip hop, and really looking at what did that look like within the context of curriculum and instruction? What does that look like in terms of engaging, kids that look like me who buy out of the educational system because it doesn't speak to them? How do you then get them re-engaged through something that they endear, something that they create, then show value in that? And so when I got my doctorate, it's interesting, in 2000, I told my committee, is you and I ready for like a hip hop minded scholar? And they were like, I don't know. I said, well, you better get ready, because you just graduated. That's how you think all the time. And that's how I've done. So I've had to be about the business of creating that form of scholarship on my own. And there are other professors that do hip hop courses and activities, there are other spaces around the country that really are really going full steam in that capacity. And we're moving very slowly there, but we're getting there. But it's going into spaces where it hasn't been realized. You know, like that's why the College of Engineering is just like fertile ground, mm-hmm. for it, because of the connection between hip hop and engineering. I mean, DJing and equipment that's engineering. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You see it as such, and you know the contributors who's taken industries and just built, you know, again, millions and billions of dollars off of products for companies that are inspired by urban communities where it's been decimated. So I want to say, hey, wait a minute. You know, you guys need to think about how do you develop that type of company or something in your own communities and begin looking at ways to partner with folks from different spaces, from different parts of the world, to then produce products that can offer jobs and change, you know, the conditions of those spaces that are troubled. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I, as you know, I also teach at the university, yeah. and sometimes yeah. I have students in engineering in my classes, sure. and I'm just going to make an assumption that the courses that you teach are probably really different from the courses that those engineering students tend yeah. to take. Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about your approach to pedagogy yes. and, yeah. and how, you know, these various concerns that you've mentioned inform yeah. the educational experience that you create for your students, especially sure. within the context of the College of Engineering.
I know, right? It's been, you know, when I started the class, I really wanted to understand how kids, I don't even call them kids, young adults, chose to come to the U of I, number one. And then what was the process for you getting in that seat? You know, and I talked mm-hmm. to them about, you know, me as a kid coming up, even I grew up, I mean, U of I has been in my backyard since the day I was born. Mm-hmm. I've always known the campus, but not within the context of how I know, you know, and so I want to know how you got in the chair, you know, what did it take to do that? Mm-hmm. And so I always say that they're the experts in the room because they're the ones sitting in the chairs. They know everybody didn't get in, but they did, right? Mm-hmm. And so I created a blog that I've opened up. It's decodingdrdre.blogspot.com. And you can go on and you can read the comments. I pose a series of questions. And I want people to see the thinking process behind young people thinking about culture, thinking about engineering, and what does it look like from an urban perspective? How do you create value within that context? And can that be realized over and over again? And so people, I said, because there's one I asked, I said, so what is your algorithm? And they're like, well, I don't think there is an algorithm for becoming an engineering student. I said, well, let's define what algorithm is. And so we talk about a process. I said, and they'll explain the choices they made to actually get there. I said, so yes, there was an algorithm for how you got here. I said, it's your own personal algorithm, but it was one. I said, in your experience might be the one that leads that kid that may even have a pistol and have given up on life, angry at the world, want to take somebody out. They might read your post and say, wait a minute. I remember when I looked at so-and-so, but it just never got realized. Mm-hmm. It's that very instance. And that's what is always exciting to me is what is it that these young people are creating that can be shared with someone else to make their life a bit like life better. And so the students talk about it now. And they said, and they talk about, you should read the comments. They're like, you know, I've never thought about engineering from the perspective that I'm getting it from now creatively. Looking at it, you know, in a very unpacked way and not just so linear and just on one thing, to be very broad in scope. And I remember one just in a recent posting, one of the students said, you know, in engineering, we don't think about the way things are. We think about the way things could be. That is so powerful.
That's fascinating.
And that, yeah. And so I like that level of thinking. And so I just got approved for a second class called Hip Hop Entrepreneurship that's in the Tech Entrepreneurship Center, and it'll start in the spring. And the whole idea, again, is to really look at, I want to know how Dr. Dre did what he did, you know, and I also want to know, because part of what he's establishing and demonstrating is that what I would consider hip hop philanthropy is going to happen as he's a cultural industrialist. And so at some point, in terms of how other folks from the Industrial Revolution did, whether it's Carnegie and other folks that created universities and contributed dollars to social causes because they were considered the industrial leadership that defined things, mm-hmm. I think something similar can happen with those that are from Dre, that's from Compton. It's like, okay, man, you're from Compton, so what are you going to do about that? You know, how do you still relate to that, or do you want to do something about that? And I think, sure, why not? But he has to learn how to get it done. Mm-hmm. If you were handed, you know, close to $1 billion, you've never had that before. I mean, that you have to take generations in to begin understanding what to do with that type of resource and to how it could impact people's lives. So that's what's exciting to me, is that this engineering school, you know, being one of the best in the world, has decided to want to take on hip hop to really begin exploring ways that young people can begin creating things that all these different companies are looking for and spending their research dollars on to invest in. And that's major.
I think the student comment that you mentioned about how engineering thinks about how the world could be is so fascinating, because sure. I hadn't really thought about engineering as kind of engaging with fiction in a way, mm-hmm. like imagining mm-hmm. a possibility and having that imaginative space be just as valued as sure. what actually comes into being.
Absolutely.
And that made me think of something that you were mentioning before we started the conversation, which is about a current project that you're working towards on yeah. engineering and play. Could you mm-hmm. talk a little bit about how you see play fitting into that future time?
That's exciting. So, you know, U of I, you know, created this iSTEM initiative, and one of my former professors led that that effort, and it's now realized at Booker T. Washington School, and the iSTEM magnet school at Booker T. is just one that brought together Champaign Unit 4 administrators, U of I professors to think about STEM within this particular context. My thing is, okay, but does that get kids from my neighborhood, which is right in the backyard, in my backyard? Mm-hmm. I played on Booker T's lot many a day, and from being very small to teenage years, and never thought about academically, you know, what could happen in terms of the young people that go to school there, the families that go there, the resources that are there, and then what does that mean as part of being part of the matriculation process for getting these kids to consider U of I or a school at the level of U of I 10 years from the moment they're in elementary school or whatever the case may be. And so looking at STEM from an urban perspective, I call it U STEM, you know, so urban science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. So what does that mm-hmm. look like? What does urban STEM look like? I think, again, about ghetto genius. I think about a young man that we grew up named Bolton, who would come down the street, and we would see him part of the day. He'd be walking to the junkyard, and when he comes back, he has a bike frame, wheels, and a couple things, and about three and four of his buddies. I got it. We'll see Joe later on that evening, and he have built a bike. He's put a recording studio on the bike. He's lit the whole bike up with batteries and
that's
a sound
amazing.
System. Yeah. And I was like, that's engineering right there. I said, and so, but Joe didn't get an opportunity to get that realized, you know, so he's still a geek now. I mean, he still does that stuff. He still builds bikes. He still does all that amazing stuff. And he's just an amazing mind. And I was like, okay, what if he had got an opportunity to really explore that even further, right? What could Joe be doing within that particular context? What about the boy that just got murdered in Chicago and lured into, I mean, who could that kid have been, you know, if that situation, if that community wasn't ill, you know, because young people that shot and killed him are pissed off, and they're not pissed off at the 9-year-old. He's just, you know, part of the situation. Mm-hmm. They're pissed off about life because they feel they've been forgotten about. And I've had some young people from Wendell Phillips High that came down last spring semester and talked about, I asked them, I said, why are people in Chicago shooting so much? And I said, because y'all know who the people are. You're just doing it. And they're like, you know why people are shooting? I'm like, why? They said, because people feel like society's forgotten about us. And so mm-hmm. when there's no hope and there's despair and desolation, you know, you're going to have things like that realized because people don't think there's value in that, right? They see that person as a reflection of themselves. They don't even value themselves. They don't give a damn, right? So my thing is to, let me show you, wait a minute, let me find out what you value, because you value something. Mm-hmm. But let's start there. And then maybe we can enter into a dialogue to make you think twice about the choices you make as it relates to pulling the trigger or doing something like that, that could just totally change a condition or a life situation of a young person. So I want to give kids an opportunity from those spaces to know that what they create has great value. And so we know that the playground is one of the most authentic spaces to learn and grow from, particularly in the hood, right? And so great dances have been realized in playgrounds that we've seen blow up and become very successful and emulated around the world. Culturals do that. And now with technology, you'll see kids in China doing a Soulja Boy dance. I mean, they're into it and it's that vivid. And so that's value. That's cultural value. As they wouldn't assign it in and start mimicking Soulja Boy. So But that also has a dollar and cents tied to it, too. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, what does that look like? How do we make certain that their young part of this opportunity, if it's going to be exploited, they need to get part of that resource that comes off of that so they can also build better homes, better schools, reinvest in their parks, all the things that make life whole in terms of social. That needs to happen within the context of urban STEM. And so this is about teaching teachers. And then the other part is we have more and more young female white teachers going into urban spaces and teaching. And so you have young women who have never experienced hood coming in with boys who have never experienced them, trying to figure it out in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes it explodes. And so I'm like, okay, we need to change that narrative by letting culture become part of that. But it has to be the appropriate culture, too. It has to be culture that is appreciated by the young people that create it. You know, there's a whole reality that young people have that has disengaged from society as we know it, that has its own cultural norms and values. You have to tap into that first if you're going to get them to buy into what you're selling in terms of academics. Excuse me. And so I think that that urban playground, this new project that we're talking about, would be that. And so we're calling it Urban Playground Tech Entrepreneurship Academy. Mm-hmm. And really beginning the conversation about STEM and entrepreneurship, because these young people here in the College of Engineering, they're talking about entrepreneurship and they're taking their ideas. And I just went to Social Fuse a couple of days ago, and Jed Taylor and the whole tech entrepreneurship team put on a phenomenal event with hundreds of young people in there talking about their ideas. And these are tomorrow's world leaders. They're in the room. They're going to be the ones that own the companies, making the hiring decisions, going to be doing all that. And you have to be part of that conversation. And so I want our young people to be part of the conversation.
Well, before the show, you were saying that you feel like there aren't enough spaces or opportunities for intimacy in our sped up technological world. And one thing that strikes me as I'm thinking about this conversation is how many times you've mentioned asking people about their experience or just looking at the spaces that we're already in, ways that those spaces can be reused for different purposes or activated for different things. So to finish out, I'm wondering if you see your work related to the process of creating intimacy in communities.
Sure, I do. And I'll tell you, because I think that community is very intimate, is very personal. You know, people have to trust each other. You know, they have to appreciate each other. And people have to get motivated about change. And you asked me about pedagogy early. And so one of the things that I've been working on is something called situational pedagogy. Mm-hmm. And so how do you use not even looking at reality pedagogy, because I have a colleague that focuses on reality pedagogy. I said, no, that's part. And that is something that is authentic. But situational pedagogy, in my opinion, is motivating. Mm-hmm. You have to be motivated to change. And so what is your life situation calling you to do? And then how do you get that done? And so how do I create pedagogy that's going to appreciate your situation and then get you motivated to want to then try to solve this through these procedures? And then how do you create your algorithm based on that to find the success that you're looking for?
Well, Will, thanks so much for
joining me. I'm glad you had me. This was fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Absolutely.
You've been listening to Smile Politely Radio. SmilePolitely.com is the place to go for all things local, arts, culture, food and drink, music, tech opinion, and lots more. Stay tuned for Hip Express, which is after that. Will's going to take my seat in just a minute. Have a good weekend.